to this joint series of lectures relating to the other Hindu and Christian perspectives, jointly sponsored by the Centre for Christianity and Culture here at Regent's Park College and the Oxford Centre for Hindu Studies just along the way. I think our series so far has been both interesting and ambitious, and today perhaps we get even more ambitious because we're trying to look at two traditions in the space of one afternoon, particularly in relation to the question of violence and peacemaking, which is such an urgent issue for all of us in our contemporary world. And we have two speakers who are going to speak briefly from their own traditions, and then hopefully we can hear something of a conversation between them, and then we can join in the conversation as well. So it's a slightly different method and style we're using this afternoon, but I hope that it will prove very fruitful for all of us. To introduce our speakers, I'll introduce them both together so we don't have to interrupt the flow. First of all, Dr. Steve Finnamore, who is a graduate of Regent's Park College, was initially a lawyer, has been involved in community work and in relief work in South America, but for a number of years now, following study here, has been a Baptist minister in Bristol, in Westbury-on-Trim. But Steve has taken a particular interest in the whole question of violence and violent imagery. He wrote his doctorate on the apocalypse, and is the author of Violence, the Bible, and the End of the World, which was a little lecture given a couple of years ago, and there are a few copies available for those who might be interested at £3 a go. And Steve's going to speak first for about 20 minutes, and then I'm pleased to introduce Kenneth Valpy. Kenneth Valpy is well known to many of you. Kenneth is originally from the United States, but has been here in the UK for a number of years now, working through the Oxford Centre for Hindu Studies and completing a doctoral dissertation on Murti Shiva, the question of image worship and the notion of image worship as a way of conveying truth, an alternative way of conveying truth. It's very good of Kenneth to be here this afternoon because he has already endured his doctoral viva. So he's already had a busy day, so we're grateful for him sparing the time. So first of all, Steve, then Ken, then some conversation between them, and then we're invited to join in, hopefully. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much, Nick. Some reflections on the roots of violence and what they may have to say to us about peacemaking in the Christian tradition. The prophet Isaiah sings a love song about a vineyard. The vineyard is beautifully built and tended with great care, and when harvest time comes, its planter expects to find grapes, but finds something altogether different. The song is an allegory. The planter is God, the vineyard is God's people, the fruit God expects to find is justice, but instead he sees violence. Perhaps this famous oracle hints at a Judeo-Christian understanding of God's attitude to violence. God plants with justice in mind. God longs for justice, desires it, we might even say works for it and expects it. But too often God finds only violence. He works for justice, finds only violence. And the Christian tradition has always struggled, as we might say that God struggles, to account for violence. Some see it as an inevitable evil to be confronted, with violence in that confrontation as necessary and needed, and others see it as something to be avoided at all costs. Indeed, there is a reluctance among many of us, particularly those most active in opposing violence and those who have been its victims, to acknowledge that violence can be understood or that it may have any social purpose whatsoever. There's an understandable desire to see it as an aberration, as pointless, as something without a meaning, and any attempt to explain it or account for it is seen as collusion with it. And so, if I appear to be colluding with violence, I ask your forgiveness. I want to suggest that violence is a distortion of a phenomenon which is built into the fabric of the universe, and that that distortion has its roots in the way that human desire has been refashioned. Let me quote some words of Aldous Huxley. Homer was wrong, wrote Heraclitus of Ephesus. Homer was wrong in saying, would that strife might perish from among gods and men. He did not see that he was praying for the destruction of the universe, for if his prayer were heard, all things would pass away. To me, it seems a reasonable prayer, a spirited pagan version of the bland prayer for peace offered in so many of our churches as an intercession for the world. After all, in the church we may not know much, but we do know that war is bad and peace is good. We know what we are against, and we're against violence. But our prayers and longings for peace are often naive and inadequate. One of the problems is that peace is so hard to imagine. Perhaps the noblest vision of everlasting peace within the Christian tradition, one where every source of strife is removed, is found in the book of Revelation. Yet the vision is couched in fantastical language. The vision offers us something that is beyond our powers to envisage. The heavenly Jerusalem is shaped like a cube. Its walls are 1,500 miles high and 75 yards thick. On each side are 12 gates, each made of a single pearl. The gates are always open. They are open all day and there is no night. The seer has no language to describe the home of God or God's people at the end of history other than the nonsensical, absurd or fanciful. It is beyond human words and capacity to envisage. The Old Testament visions of peace are more literal and correspondingly less effective. They function well as inspiring poetry, which is, I suppose, their primary purpose, but they won't do as a focus for long-term human aspiration. You plant vineyards, you enjoy the fruit. You get to sit under your own fig tree. The wild and domestic animals get along famously. But then what? It seems so dull, so boring. There's no challenge, no excitement, no risk, no nothing. In these circumstances, we can imagine no story, and without a story, we have no meaning. Homer may have yearned for strife to end, but had his prayer been answered, there would have been nothing for him to write about. No dispute between Greece and Troy, no anger between Achilles and Agamemnon, no baddies preventing Odysseus from returning to his home, and no suitors competing for Penelope when he got there. Strife, conflict, desire, dispute are integral to the stories that humans tell and to the activities in which we engage. Take them away and we struggle to think of anything meaningful. Take them away, you lose everything from sport to intellectual inquiry. There's a moment in David Lodge's novel Small World when a young academic attending a major language and literature conference asks a question of a panel of distinguished literary critics called together to discuss the function of criticism. He says, "What follows if everybody agrees with you?" Subsequently clarified as, "What do you do if everybody agrees with you?" And the chair of the panel, the doyen of literary critics, sees the point. "You imply, of course," he says, "that what matters in the field of critical practice is not truth, but difference. If everybody were convinced by your arguments, they would have to do the same as you, and there would be no satisfaction in doing it. To win is to lose the game." In other words, once the critics agree, there is an end to dialogue and to dispute. The discipline is finished. It is strife that keeps the participants involved. Sweet agreement comes only with the eschaton. What stories could be told about people who live in peace? Even television series about happy families and apparently peaceful communities, such as The Waltons or The Little House on the Prairie, rely on strife within or without the family to provide a catalyst for their narratives. Otherwise, nothing would happen at all. A soap opera in which all the characters were polite and got on well with one another is unimaginable. There would be no story, nothing would ever happen, and nobody would watch. Ancient art bears out these observations. The stories, the things represented in art, are largely violent. If they're not about violence, they're about sex. And if they're about sex, they're often about illegitimate sex. Adultery, promiscuity, incest, rape. The kinds of sex which involve or provoke conflict. Sex, violence, or both. Perhaps Freud was not mistaken in regarding the story of Oedipus as archetypal. Christians have too often asked how violence might be overcome, and all too rarely wondered what would be left if it were. Violence and strife are the presumed context for everything from ancient myths of creation to contemporary post-Nietzschean social theory. If we overcome violence, are we left with the options only of boredom or annihilation? The Christian meta-narrative suggests that humans were made for a relationship with God, that humans disrupted this relationship and consequently their own and God's relationship with the rest of creation, that God has acted in Jesus Christ to restore this relationship and that everything will culminate in a restored humanity, in a restored creation. In this story, desire plays a vital role, both in making things go wrong and in sorting them out once more. According to Genesis 1, the world God made, and which God repeatedly declared to be good, was a place in which work needed to be done. Within the original mandate to humans was the call to subdue the earth, and this must imply a degree of conflict. Creation needed some part of itself, humanity, to act as God's representatives in keeping it under control, in imposing order. Only subsequently does this necessary task become distorted so that humans commit violence. Purpose, desire, conflict were all perhaps part of the original intention. And it's very difficult to know how this prelapsarian subjection should be understood. Perhaps it's a continuing participation in God's work of imposing order on chaos. It may be understood in terms of the imposition of culture, the practice of cultivation, the herding of animals, and so on. These things involve a degree of what we now call violence, but this prelapsarian proto-violence becomes distorted as a result of the fall. It lapses into violence because human covetousness leads to the refocusing of human desire. Humans become unable or unwilling to exercise adequate control of the actions necessarily involved in subjection. This idea that the distortion of a necessary human activity leads to violence can function whether you understand the fall as an historical event, as a mythical representation of something which occurred among our ancestors, or myth per se. Christian theology, taking its lead from the Apostle Paul, as interpreted by Augustine, has tended to trace humanity's broken relationship with God to the story in Genesis 3, in which Eve and Adam eat the fruit which God has forbidden to them. And in the Genesis account, the serpent tempts Eve with the thought that consuming the forbidden fruit will make her godlike. There is transgression of a given law. There is, I suppose, theft. But the root issue seems to be one of covetousness. The first humans lose their initial status because they desire something which belongs to another. And the motive for the desire is not the fruit itself, but what the fruit represents. To possess the fruit which belongs to another is to seek to acquire the status of the other. That is, to be like God. This distortion of desire continues apace in contemporary advertising. Products are very rarely advertised on the basis of what they can do. More often, a model is depicted owning and using the product. The model is presented as someone worthy of emulation, indeed as someone whose being is to be desired. The product, then, is to be seen not as something worth having in its own right, but as a means to acquiring the being of the model. Of course, the process is illusory. The acquisition of the product does not result in the acquisition of another's being, and naturally the consumer is left unsatisfied. This is all to the good from the perspective of the advertiser, for the consumer's desire for being can be tantalised in subsequent advertisements. Essentially, adverts are designed to provoke covetousness in the viewer. The offence of Adam and Eve was not in itself a violent one, but according to the writer, a compiler of Genesis, its consequences are undoubtedly so. The covetous act is the precursor of violence. Cain envies the fact that his brother's sacrifice was acceptable to God and murders him. The presence of violence within the culture leads to the celebration of violence, which reaches its nadir in the boastful, in the spiteful boasting of Lamech. In the preamble to the story of the flood, the sons of God covet and then acquire the fair daughters of men for their wives. Whatever that story may be about, and I've no idea, covetousness has now reached a cosmic dimension. The humans are said to be wicked, but the only way that the nature of this evil is specified is that we are told that the earth was filled with violence. Covetousness and violence go hand in hand. In these circumstances, it's not surprising that an injunction against covetousness should find its way into the Decalogue. Nevertheless, the 10th commandment strikes 21st century ears as strange and out of place. It attempts to prohibit a personal disposition which need not lead to any harmful action. Of itself, it leaves no evidence. It will be almost impossible to prove it in a court of law unless the covetous one confessed. Unlike most of the other commandments, particularly those others which deal with relations between humans, the order not to covet would have been virtually impossible to enforce. Furthermore, we live in a culture in which covetousness is no longer seen as being taboo. Indeed, it is provoked and encouraged in advertising and in pornography. The viewer is encouraged to desire something which is not theirs. Our desire for things expressed in consumption is the engine which drives the market economy. The consumer is to aspire to possess things which will bestow or enhance a sense of being. And in these days of mass production of identical items, it is possible for many people to possess the same object. Covetousness can be provoked without being seen to promote conflict or violence. However, the psychological and social effects of the promotion of the idea that we lack being and the false suggestion that this lack can be remedied by shopping are difficult to predict. Furthermore, where the advertising of the West is seen in the South, as it is, desire is provoked, but there are often no means by which the objects of desire may legitimately be acquired. The poor are excluded from this game, and this has the potential to unleash an unstoppable violence. There are powerful reasons that the ancient taboo against covetousness has disintegrated. In the ancient world, there was only one of anything. Products were not mass-produced. One pot or sword or donkey could be distinguished from all others. If you desired something possessed by your neighbour, you could not go to the shop and choose an identical one from the shelf. Your options were to overcome the covetousness or steal it. Industrialisation and mass advertising have changed this completely. The breakdown on taboos, on covetousness, is extending into sex. Models and actors in magazines, film and television use body language that deliberately incites sexual desire in the viewer. Of course, the models are dehumanized in the process so that they become interchangeable. They are objects of desire, but not personal. There is no reason to desire any one of them rather than the other. They have become commodities. Now, while this phenomenon is sometimes condemned, quite rightly, by anti-pornography activists and sometimes by the models themselves who say, nobody treats me like a person, it does offer some defense against the provocation to desire being understood personally. But when this defense does break down, as it inevitably must because the boundaries involved are so ambiguous, those who misunderstand the nature of the signals being sent engage in celebrity fixation, stalking, and related activities. The communications media claim the right to freely represent whatever they choose, but deny any responsibility for the consequences that are provoked. So, covetousness, a desire for something which we do not own or for someone who is not our legitimate sexual partner, drives global capitalism and yet is prohibited by the 10th commandment because of its propensity to provoke violence. Indeed, there is a sense in which covetousness is to be understood as the most common motive for breaking of the previous four commandments, those against murder, adultery, theft, and bearing false witness. Of course, these four offences commonly lead to violence as retribution is sought. In other words, the injunction against covetousness is an injunction against the human emotion which most often provokes violence. The final commandment seeks to prohibit the form of desire which could become the motive for the preceding four. And it's possible that the Apostle Paul understood covetousness to be the heart of the human dilemma. Certainly, when he discusses the law in Romans 7, it is the commandment against covetousness which is taken as the epitome of the law. And it is covetousness which introduces sin into the world. Now, desire is part of the human makeup. And at its best, it is the desire for a relationship with God and participation in God's own creativity. This desire is distorted and becomes covetousness. Humans seek to acquire the being of God, hence to control God. It's related to idolatry. The search for God readily becomes idolatrous as it focuses on the self and upon those who claim the attributes of God. Other traditions recognize that the roots of the human dilemma lie in desire. Some argue that human fulfillment lies in the abandonment of desire. Christianity doesn't seek to overcome it in that way. Or in contrast to secular materialism or postmodernism or whatever other name you may wish to give to the cultural norms generated by the current manifestations of Western capitalism, Christianity does not teach that all desires are to be indulged. Or rather, to put it into political and economic terms, that our main right as humans is that of choice, our choice being which limited number of our unlimited desires we will indulge with our limited resources. Instead, the Judeo-Christian tradition distinguishes between different kinds of desire. Those which constitute covetousness are prohibited. Others are to be enjoyed. However, all are to be understood in the light of a prior commitment to desire God and his will, or as Jesus expresses it, to seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. In the Gospels, Jesus displays a form of humanity which is without covetousness. This aspect of the story reaches its climax in the Garden of Gethsemane. Here, Jesus demonstrates a desire for God which overcomes even his love of his own life. Speaking of his own death, he says, "Take this cup from me, yet not what I desire, but what you desire." We are not, I think, to understand that God desires the death of Jesus, still less that God kills him. Rather, that God desires from him an obedience which will result in his being killed by others. The submission of human desire to the desire of God is at the heart of the achievement of Jesus, and the consequence is in the tradition, his exaltation to God's right hand. Adam and Eve's goal of attaining the being of God is achieved by Jesus, but it's done by the human who submits his desire to God rather than by those who embrace covetousness in the vain hope that it would make them godlike. The creation depicted within Genesis 1 to 2 is not static. There is space for human development and creativity. Humans are set on a journey into God, and the goal that Christians are offered in Christ does not take us back to Eden, where we started, but forward to the original goal for which we were made, a place where our wills are made perfect, but in which desire for God and to participate with God in God's acts and God's creativity drives human development. There remains space for creativity and learning and challenge. Now, I've scarcely touched on peacemaking, but I suspect that the contribution of Christianity per se, that Christianity per se has to make to the aspiration for peace, which we share with people of many other religious traditions and of those of none, is the understanding of human desire as something God-given and eternal, but which needs to be refocused if violence is to be reduced and peace built. And those who commit themselves to peacemaking need to consider the nature of their own desires, and in particular, the compromises which we have all made with covetousness because of our involvement in Western capitalism.
Beginning, I'll be talking in reference to this chart that you see on one side. As my examiners know, I like charts, so we'll be looking at that in a moment. First, I have a quote to read from David Smith from his new book, Hinduism and Modernity. He says, "A certain insouciance or lack of concern is shown by India in codenaming its first successful nuclear explosion, the Buddha Smiles." And in speaking of the second set of tests in 1998 as the Buddha Smiles Again. On both sides, that is India and Pakistan, these super weapons have religious connotations. The Pakistani mid-range guided missile is called the Ghazni, after the 11th century Muslim invader Mahmud of Ghazni, destroyer of the Somnath temple. But the connection is more directly religious with India, which has missiles named after the god of fire, Agni, and Shiva's trident, Trishul. And that ends the quote. We might contrast such images of weaponry associated with Indian divinities with images of peace-loving Hinduism, especially as popularized by Mohandas Gandhi, champion of nonviolence as a way of life, religion, and principle of coexistence in a troubled world. My focus this afternoon will be not on contemporary politics and Hinduism. Rather, I will look at Hindu classical tradition as it means to comprehend such contradictions, as I have just noted, and as a mapping exercise to begin a process for seeing how Hindu tradition might participate in or be a resource for a wider conversation in violence and peacemaking. So with this chart that you see, I'm intentionally oversimplifying to give us something to think with or perhaps argue against. You will notice three main rows. The first row, with the right four sections subdivided, is the realm of worldly engagement associated with the path of karma. Within this sphere, one acknowledges a biotic necessity and inevitability of violence and aims to contain it by various scripturally sanctioned means, particularly through the ancient Vedic sacrifice in which animals were ritually slaughtered, and the Dharma Yudha, the religious fight. Violence is seen as a necessary evil that, if properly contained, conspires to keep the world order and the social order. One acknowledges the other largely as a competitor in a world of limited resources and hopes to win a privileged position for enjoying desirable things, if not in this life, in the next. The second row shows the sphere of world negation associated with the paths of yoga and jnana or dhyana. No world means no violence, since there is ultimately no other to fight with. The enemy is one's own desires aimed at gaining objects of enjoyment that don't really exist with a body that is ephemeral. Again, violence is to be contained by impositions of force on oneself through yogic disciplines, austerities, and through reflective deconstruction of all but the eternal and singular self to the point of release from all desire or moksha. The bottom row shows what I'm calling the sphere of world incorporation, or the sphere of relationality associated with the path of bhakti or devotion. The word bhakti derives from the verbal root bhaj, often translated as to share. In this sphere, one aims all efforts to become part of a, what I call, logic of service, or seva, which is neither competitive nor world-denying or other-denying. Life is modeled after exemplary bhaktas, thought to demonstrate virtue ethics in ideal ways, typically as ideal sage, ideal warrior, or ideal saint, or a blend of these three. The first two of these three paths prove problematic from a bhakti perspective, as recognized variously within the tradition, both discursively and through narrative. So, in the first division, represented by the top row, what begins as the well-intentioned sacrifice and observance of royal dharma becomes, in the epic Mahabharata, the all-devastating, out-of-control war of Kurukshetra. This vision, in turn, gives way to King Yudhishthira's vision of the world's illusoriness at the end of the Mahabharata, a vision of transcendent peace, won, however, only after the cataclysmic war. But within the Mahabharata is the seed of what I am calling relationalism, proposed in the Bhagavad Gita, later expanded in the Bhagavata Purana. One example of this relationalism from the Mahabharata can be seen in Bhishma's extensive teachings to Yudhishthira, in which he urges the latter to see his place in a greater plan wherein it was necessary and appropriate for him to act violently within a certain context. Yet the encompassing principle is the pursuit and practice of nonviolence. And we'll read some excerpt from Bhishma from the Mahabharata in a moment. This relational vision supersedes the previous two visions, the world-affirming and the world-negating visions, as ultimate perfection, beyond the dichotomy of violence and peace, to a vision of perfect participation. This vision is much more developed in the Bhagavata Purana. I won't pursue this further. If you can turn your sheet over, I have three proposals for aiming at peacemaking. Three general suggestions, which are all leaning toward a bhakti understanding. First, expanding the trajectory of selfhood as a continuity from birth to rebirth. I find it quite reasonable to assume or to act under the assumption that we are real selves with histories that go beyond the limits of the present body's existence. This is Krishna's first instruction to Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita. He says, "Never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings, nor in the future shall any of us cease to be." Such an affirmation impels us to take both self and other very seriously indeed, which is not to suggest that there cannot be humor in our relationships. Similarly, the devotee Prahlad, appearing in the Bhagavad Purana, urges his young classmates to take the opportunity of this present brief human existence to pursue higher spiritual consciousness rather than waste it in ephemeral pursuits that perpetuate violence directly or indirectly. Prahlad gives an interesting analysis of the average human lifespan. He says that if you take away the years spent in the distractions of childhood, the years spent struggling with old age, and the cumulative time spent sleeping. Then you add the time spent in economic and social pursuits. Precious little time indeed remains for the most important business of human life. We go to the second point on this little list of three. Second, Hindu traditions contain resources for pursuing relationality within adverse conditions of political and social oppression. One such resource is the very ancient tradition of discourse and debate. Violence is the cessation of conversation. So, skilled peacemaking discourse is a must. In Indic traditions, generally, there are extensive resources for developing skilled discourse, of which I would suggest three principles, namely, first, holding multiple viewpoints simultaneously. And this is an idea that comes from very ancient times from the writer Yaska. That is to say, accommodating in some wise differing and possibly opposing positions. Second, recognition that our lives must be oriented towards self-correction and growth, not stagnation in a fixed position. This involves skilled hearing, or shravanam in Sanskrit, and persistent questioning, with the humility to view oneself as a work in progress. And third, the pursuit and selection through careful reflection of the most important battles to be fought, or the greatest battle to be fought, not taking the lesser battles, but going to the most important, essential one. Again, Krishna's dialogue with Arjuna can be seen in this light. So, if discourse, dialogue, conversation does seem to break down, we can also take inspiration and instruction from the example of Mohandas Gandhi and others' practices of nonviolent resistance. The world has seen numerous successful applications of these principles in the last few decades, whereby people found empowerment to resist oppressive others. In regard to this last, bhakti traditions, indeed, might imbibe lessons from contemporary examples while offering examples of ideal behavior from their texts. Third, Hindu traditions, especially bhakti traditions, have resources for peacemaking through pursuing relationality between divinity and humanity and between humanity and other species. Regarding the first, one might begin with the principle of sharanagati, or surrender, by which Hindu religionists centuries ago articulated a sense of utter dependence on God, akin to what Friedrich Schleiermacher championed in the West in the 19th century. Regarding the latter, pursuing relationality between humanity and other species as a way toward peacemaking, I would suggest that Western religious traditions could profit from Hindu resources regarding the practice of a vegetarian diet. This leads into my last section on the handout, an excerpt from Bhishma's instructions to Yudhishthira in the Mahabharata. I think this theme of nonviolence associated with non-killing and eating of animals has come in varying degrees and ways over time to pervade the Hindu sense of dharma, or living in accordance with higher order. So we can look at this excerpt. This is a translation from Christopher Chappell. First from the 115th chapter of the 13th book is some general statements by Bhishma about nonviolence. He says, according to the Brahman spokesman, there are four specific nonviolence prescriptions. If one of these is neglected, there is none. O destroyer of foes. What are these four types of violence? Not to commit violence oneself, not to take what has been yielded by violence, not to pay someone to commit violence and not to approve any violent act. So he's suggesting here there are broad implications of violence on many dimensions, and he's also emphasizing agency, that we are agents even if we approve of someone else acting violently. Then he says, just as the tracks of a snake and the footprints of other animals are all covered over in the footprints of an elephant, so in all worlds, nonviolence is proclaimed to be the highest dharma. So this is saying if nonviolence is practiced, all ethical, moral, and religious obligations are met. A bit more specifically, in the next section, Vishnu says, first, the difficulty of observing nonviolence and vegetarianism specifically should be acknowledged. Having initially eaten meat, to renounce it is better than all knowledge and all sacrifice, O Bharata. It is known indeed that to refuse meat is difficult. To hold this vow by which all things are made fearless is excellent. And in the next two verses, he gives a kind of definition of wisdom. That wise person who bestows the gift of fearlessness on all creatures is known in the world without doubt as the giver of life. The wise ones who regard the life of beings as their own breath praise this highest dharma. Then he makes a statement which may be uncomfortable for some of us, a rhetorical question really. What indeed can be the worth of a life that carries on with the sin of subsisting on flesh, killing those that are healthy and free of fault? And then he gives the injunction. Therefore, O king, be enjoined to refuse meat. This is the ancient high dharma that brings heaven and happiness. Nonviolence is the highest dharma. Nonviolence is the highest austerity. Nonviolence is the highest truth. By this, dharma or religion is done. So to close, I'll first quote Professor Francis Clooney, whose article on vegetarianism addressed to Christians is in a book which I have referred to here on your handout. He gives the following suggestion, particularly to a Christian audience. He says, it is my suggestion that vegetarianism offers one plausible, effective way in which the contemporary Christian can again integrate the more speculative and general concerns of the church with a concrete personal piety. The experiment in vegetarianism, when undertaken prudently and with sufficient reflection, can offer a solid contribution toward the development of new and dynamic forms of spirituality. That's the end of the quote. I would suggest that vegetarianism, now widely accepted in the West as a viable alternative diet by many, deserves more serious consideration as a real, consequential, and doable means of bringing significantly more peace to this world. Vegetarianism is by no means the property of Hinduism. Indeed, arguably, it was most clearly articulated by Jains as far as Indic religion goes. Be that as it may, its wider active adoption could, I feel, do much to stem the tide of institutional violence that so plagues us today. So, my three suggestions, or my three suggested ways that Hindu traditions might contribute to the issues revolving around violence and its avoidance or resolution through peacemaking efforts, are rooted largely in this third relational worldview known as the path of bhakti. Each of these have to do with expanding or deepening the sense of self, first in terms of the self's persistence beyond this life, second in terms of relation to other human beings, and third in terms of relationality to non-human or superhuman beings. I'm aware that this threefold scheme may sound overly simplistic, if not naive, but just as a physical illness may involve very complex causes, and a hugely complex biophysical process of recovery. The diseased condition of our world today similarly can be attributed to complex causes. Yet a cure may be possible by proper medicine, restricted diet, and good measure of exercise balanced with rest. Hindu traditions, notwithstanding any number of extremes in expression, such as the naming of nuclear weapons after Hindu divinities, hold a good deal of common sense for helping an ailing world recover its balance and to contain the untold volume and extent of contemporary violence, if not to eliminate it entirely. When you talked about advertising, commodities are presented by or together or in the context of persons who are then depersonalized. What struck me there were two things. One is whether or not some of this idea of desiring the being of the other is coming from René Girard. Mm-hmm. Whether you would like to expand on that at all.
Well, yes, a lot of my ideas about desire are strongly influenced by my reading of Girard, who, as many of you will know, talks a great deal about the fundamental human drive, which he refers to as mimetic or imitative desire, where the nearest biblical concept that I've been able to find is covetousness, to desire the being of another. And where he says that we imitate others, we seek to acquire what they acquire, and that's a fundamental drive that we have, not because we necessarily give any inherent value to the thing which they possess, so much as desiring their being. So we find ourselves a model and we desire what they possess in order that we may possess their being. So yes, it is strongly influenced by Girard and has influenced my reading of the texts.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking about connecting this with institutional violence.
Mm-hmm.
The advertising industry seems, as you've presented it, so much perpetuating a kind of what some would call an institutional violence. Another side of institutional violence that's been articulated by some writers on vegetarianism point out, for example, that the production line first began in Chicago with the slaughterhouse industry. So a kind of connection is made there between, continue from there. Some have also made the observation that the Holocaust, the wholesale death camps, the killing of the Jews in Germany and so on, was done in a kind of production line way, and that this sort of automation process has very much served the automation, the institutionalization of
the industrialization of violence, if you will.
Yeah.
And industrialization has a depersonalizing effect, I think. Mm-hmm. And so those would go hand in hand. Can I ask?
Please.
Can I point back very briefly? It is interesting that the Indian government chose to name its weapons after Hindu deities. Mm. In the West, we do a neat trick. We name our weapons after pagan deities.
We take the names from the Greek and the Roman pantheon. As though to dissociate ourselves. It's not really ours. We're, of course, a Judeo-Christian civilization when we want to sound good about ourselves. Mm. But these things which we're not too sure about, we'll give the names of pagan gods to. That's an interesting kind of exercise in denial and going on there. The other thing that I reflected on while you were speaking was the way that in the West all religion was actively sacrificial, and all killing of animals for food was highly ritualized, either in the hunt or in sacrifice. And with the coming of Christianity, and particularly the book of Hebrews, and the idea that the death of Christ is the final sacrifice, there is, we don't have sacrifice, active sacrifice, once Christianity becomes the dominant religion in the West. So killing of animals, rather than stopping, becomes completely desacralized, as far as the Christian traditions are concerned, although it remains sacralized to a degree within Judaism and within Islam. And this seems to me to feed in, that the fact that we've desacralized it enables the industrialization of process, so that the relationality between Christians in our tradition and the animals is broken, and we've industrialized what previous cultures in the West had sacralized. That hadn't thought of it that way before, and so I have to think through that issue. I think it's very helpful to me.
Some modern teachers of Hinduism would make such a recommendation that if you want to eat meat, then kill yourself, or have some kind of sacrificial context in which all of that goes on. There's some story about Leo Tolstoy that a guest came to his house and asked, "Where is the meat?" And he directed this person to go into his kitchen. There's the knife. There's the cow. I would have perhaps one question on you. This is actually not originating from me, but from one writer, Hector Avalos, who asks, why is it that in the Judeo-Christian traditions there has, with the so much description of violence in the scriptures, why has there not been more of an allegorizing and an internalizing, or a saying that this is about an internal conflict? Is that an appropriate question? Is he wrong to assume that is not the case, that there has been such allegorizing of descriptions of violence in the Bible?
Well, there certainly have been, throughout the tradition of the church, attempts to allegorize, an insistence on allegorizing the great battles in the book of Joshua and so on, and explaining them in terms of spiritual realities. But the triumph of historical critical ways of reading the scripture have allowed the violence to resurface as an issue for us. So whereas the allegorical readings were tolerated, the historical criticism pushes the existence of the violence back to the surface in history and sees it as real, where once it would have been overread. I think that's fair. Can I ask something about, where was it? The abandonment of sacrifice. I mean, you talked in this the world-affirming tradition about sacrifice and about its role in maintaining social structures, which is again reminds me of some of Girard's ideas about the role of sacrifice. It seems to me that the abandonment of sacrifice in the West raises some questions about what we do to contain violence. And I think that we've embraced sport, athletic competition, ritual battle, with words like attack and defence, so enthusiastically that it must say something about what we've sublimated. And I wondered if where sacrifice has been abandoned in Hindu traditions, where that's happened, if it's happened, whether it's been found that it's been found necessary.
Cricket.
it's indeed a pop battle, isn't it?
They take it very seriously in India.
Perhaps it's also gone into the Bollywood film industry. The Mahabharata series, which was broadcast in recent years, and the Ramayana series that were broadcast, it's been reported that India stopped as each of the episodes were broadcast. So one might say that this has been one way that sacrifice has been kind of internal. But another way is the modern industrial complex, if you like, has come to pervade India with incredible speed. And I would say that the fire of sacrifice has now gone underneath a smokestack in the factory, which is now producing the Tata automobile and so on. And that has become a way of controlling or containing the violence.
Capitalism. Industrial capitalism.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Let's open the conversation up. Some others of us might want to make a comment or ask a question and share ideas.
Can I ask about something more about desire, which was a very strong feature of Steve's presentation, which I think he was wanting to say that within the Christian view of creation, desire in fact does have a positive place, but is distorted into covetousness and hence into violence, which I think is obviously a main line of the Christian tradition. Within the second form, as it were, way of Hinduism here, there is of course a strong emphasis on denying desire. Where does desire fit within the third track of the world reconciling which you prefer to take yourself? Can you say something about the status of desire within that?
Their desire would not be denied by any means. Rather, it would be seen as something to be transformed, but better perhaps to say recovered to its original form. In Sanskrit, you have two terms. One is kama, which has a wide range of connotations, but usually is oriented toward worldly desire. In the, at least the bhakti tradition that I'm familiar with, the sort of opposite of that is called prema or preman, which is usually translated as simply love and is associated with the love of God. An analogy is sometimes given that as gold and iron are both metals and yet have vastly different values, so prema and kama have a common denominator, but they are vastly different in value.
Would you see that as being very much like the Christian tradition here, or would you see a difference within it? I'd like to know, how it feels.
No, I would say there's very much a similarity there in the non-rejection of desire, of will, and the implications of that, that one is, well, I see Christianity is very much acknowledging this principle of relationality. We have that in the notion of the Trinity, of course, and one is pursuing a state of being related with the Trinity. Differences will certainly be there. Perhaps for the moment, though, we can emphasize the similarity.
Thank you.
Yes, one.
I don't know how perfect this is, but two thoughts came to me as we were listening. One is I've been doing some studying on the idea of Satan, or the devil, and I'm led by your discussion to thoughts around the way that the idea of evil has been internalized quite differently in a Western tradition, and how that has led to a certain area of violence to the self, which is analyzed or described through psychotherapy. It's very present in the use of the word trauma. And whether that has any relevance to this discussion about what people in the West have done with certain ways of thinking about violence in themselves and in society at large. I mean, there's a way in which I sometimes see the emphasis on the violence done to the individual as a huge distraction from ways of dealing with societal or spiritual violence, if you like. And I'd just be interested to know if that has any value whatsoever. Thought, and the other thought that occurred to me too was the role that postmodernism as a way of thinking plays in this idea of relationality. Mm. It suddenly occurred to me as you were speaking too that if you're no longer in a position of an us and a them, or a conflict of opposites, but modern ways of the postmodern way of thinking is to make you see provisionality in everything. This may be a good thing. It gets a lot of bad press, but there are certain ways in which this may. So those are just my two.
Goodness. I think they're great thoughts. I'm not sure what to do with them, or whether I have anything constructive to add to them. I certainly think that there are very positive things about what gets called postmodernity. Although I think there are negative things too. Like everything else, it's a mixed blessing. But certainly the provisionality that we all now almost automatically give to our earnest declarations seems to be a good thing, and a lesson, and humility that many of us need to learn. And it's helpful that we now present ourselves in that way. On the other question, I suppose we all are terribly concerned about the way in which so many people are expressing violence, but many of them not having an external object for it, but are exercising that violence against themselves, either in the form of eating disorders or self-harm, or ritual self-mutilation, which finds, I suppose, the nearest thing I can think to a positive expression of that is in the kind of multiple piercing and multiple tattooing that you see, where that's kind of done systematically and thoughtfully and, by and large, safely. But where it's not done in that way, it's the ritual, the self-ritualized marking of the body is a sign of that there are the traumas, to use your word, tensions which are unresolved and which are being, as you say, internalized and put back, and that onto the person themselves, and that seems to be increasing. And so I share your concern, and it's an interesting thought, but I don't have anywhere to go with it.
Postmodernism, indeed. Somehow we've all been cursed by this term, I think. What is beyond the post has been asked. Some have made a distinction between deconstructive and constructive postmodernism. And while I've spent most of my time struggling to understand postmodernism and finding out that it really had mainly to do with this deconstructive postmodernism, I was very relieved to find out that there's something called constructive postmodernism, and I'm still eager to find out what it is.
You can make it up as you go.
As for sort of self-destructive tendencies and violence turned inward, I would say in connection with Hindu traditions that what I described in the second category might be viewed as a kind of self-destruction, but it is rather understood as a self-recovery. Mm-hmm. And it's a highly, highly developed, one might say, technology. Well, what all of that which is in the first category, the sacrifice, that is also about a kind of technology, you might say, which nowadays no one seems to know, and therefore there's no kind of channeling process for such effort, and therefore it goes all out of control and becomes indeed destructive in a non-positive way. Something can be positively deconstructive. There are rituals in Indian worship where you deconstruct the self before you reconstruct the self to worship the deity. But where it is simply self-destruction, you're simply left with a mess. And yes, I would agree, that's what we are seeing going on today. There's no training direction.
It's interesting, this kind of self-abuse is sacralized in the medieval tradition, where, especially among female saints, where you see this kind of self-harm, but it's almost presented as something worthy. Well, it is presented as something worthy and self-denying. So yes, it's there, isn't it?
The gentleman at the back and then the lady over here. Yes, please.
When I probed human motivations, it's true that desire and distortion of desire figures. There's another word which is always there, and it's fear. And in the Christian tradition, I've come across writing by John McMurray, in that he says the central message of Jesus was to save us from fear. And in the Hindu tradition, on your handout, there is a reference to fearlessness. I'm just wondering whether you could dwell for a few seconds on the role of fear in each of the traditions.
Well, getting back to my little chart, the emphasis would be that this worldly orientation will have these two aspects, desire and fear, which one is negotiating in the course of one's practice of religious activities and religious culture. And that's, you might say, the advertising point, one of the main advertising points from the bhakti traditions, is that indeed you will be always under the hold of desire and fear as long as you don't turn toward God and surrender to God, and that only by that process you will become free from fear. The emphasis in one verse I'm thinking of, it says that by this path of karma, or it says bhukti mukti siddhi kami shakali ashanta, all of the normal ways we think of as making life better for ourselves, religious pursuits of all kinds, all of them lead to a lack of peacefulness, ashanta. Krishna bhakti nishkama ataeva shanta. The direction of our desire toward God, which is free from desire, gives one peace. And that peace implies that one is free from fear.
Well, I'm glad you went first, because I had no idea what I was going to say. While you were speaking in languages I didn't understand.
Sorry.
I was grateful because I was just going back to the story which I've used as my guiding story, Genesis 1 through 3. a consequence of the distortion of desire. And it is one of the first results. They're afraid. They're no longer, their relationship with God is such that they now have an unhealthy fear of God. And it is true that in the rest of the tradition, the Book of Psalms, for example, that fear is constantly addressed, and God is seen as a source of security and safety, because the human condition is now one of being afraid. But it seems to me that in the story, it flows from the distortion of desire, and so it would be natural for Jesus to address that. You know, do not be afraid, as he says, particularly as in the Gospel of John, we see that do not let your hearts be troubled approach. But that seems to me to go hand, you know, to be part of the refocusing of desire, which we see ultimately in Gethsemane and the cross in the story of Jesus. Yes.
Let me continue from Adam and Eve there. Cain, he killed his brother Abel, that was envy as well.
I agree.
And when he, because of his nature, he, all the human race, we have the same nature as Adam and Eve. So that's why we lost that peace, because of the contact that was broken with God. But we find it back in Jesus, because he's the Prince of Peace, so we have to have this relationship with Jesus.
One of my professors, the late Ninian Smart, used to make an interesting comparison. There's original sin in the Christian tradition. In Indian traditions, you have original ignorance, as he called it. Peggy Morgan will probably remember him saying this. Ignorance which you cannot seem to trace back to a cause. Somehow it's been there, and we are all suffering from that. There are some zeros there.
Ignorance is bliss, is what we said. there's a Christian heresy called Gnosticism, which I don't really understand terribly well, but it is about knowledge. It does make the human dilemma a lack of knowledge and the receipt of the divine knowledge. I mean, the Gnosis is much more complicated than that, but it's to do that we need that knowledge in order to become saved. So, yeah, it seems to me that that's an interesting...
The definition of knowledge tends to roll differently in the West from the East, doesn't knowledge sound like a cold intellectual thing, perhaps, in England? If you look at the way knowledge is defined in the Gita, it's much more a moral thing about practicing the right thing.
Yes.
But knowledge has to do with a relationship. To be able to communicate with God, to talk to God as we talk to you. To be in contact with Him. To know Him, that's the way.
I thoroughly agree.
To know Him, that's peace. That's real peace.
Okay, come into the back there, and then they're going to come to my colleague Frank Kluge, who's going to remind us of some other things that are happening, and then perhaps round up for us this evening, if you would. But first, a comment over there.
I wonder if there's a difficulty in considering peace as the primary state for mankind, in the sense that we very easily take it for granted or assume that somehow that's how things should be. I'm quite struck by the traditions in which the primal state is considered to be chaos, and where sacrifice requires an extraordinary amount of effort to maintain order. And I wonder if that model might not work for us a little better, because it seems to me that we forget very easily the effort that goes into keeping and maintaining peace.
Thank you.
Just a very brief question and then a comment. I wonder if the logic of your presentations would undercut part of both traditions, namely the long tradition, let's say in the West, what's been called the just war theory, and then in India, advice to kings on how to use the stick moderately. And the idea that in a violent world, violence needs to be exercised by certain kind of prudent people. Whether or not your presentation would say that it's always going to be bad advice to advise kings on how to use violence rather than telling them simply stop.
quite sure I see how it would undercut
then
that
violence
principle.
Always leads to more violence, and so advising kings to use violence moderately doesn't actually work. The only thing is to stop.
Well, thinking of the Bhagavata Purana now, there are a lot of kind of models presented of kings who are enlightened kings, and the main example is King Parikshit, who renounces his kingdom altogether and sits down on the bank of the Ganga to hear Bhagavat. So one might say that that is a point. There are many stories where a sage will advise a king that you're not aware of what the consequences are of what you're doing. Yes, you're being very dharmic, you're making all these sacrifices, but at some point these animals that you've killed, they're all going to come back and kill you, that sort of thing. So there is
I think it's always a good idea to tell people to put that gun down.
One last comment to the back, and then we'll get Frank to wind up.
I was baptized a Christian in 1979, and in later years I've taken a huge interest in the Eastern religion. And one of the most essential things that strikes me about Hinduism and that corner of religion, mostly from the masters of India, is that the divinity of the soul is not so much talked about in the Christian religion to the extent it's talked about in the Eastern religion. And we were talking about fear a few moments ago, and one of the most essential things that has erased a lot of that fear is realizing one's divinity in the soul. And I feel by recognizing that divinity, we are able then to relate to the Almighty and to the infinite with a freer feeling of relationship. I think what I'm trying to say here is quite hard to put across, because it's rather abstract in a sense. One has to experience it. It's not something you can talk about so much. But the depth of love and the commitment and the devotion to God erases that fear. And God, I find, wants us to actually learn to maturely be mature people in this relationship with him, not to run around as fearful, frightened little beings, but to become strong and say, look, I want to learn, I want my birthright, I want to learn, I want to learn why. And it's this self-knowledge that started to come forward, this relationship about understanding oneself. I found these religions could tell me so much more, and God became enormous in that sense. The light became enormous by that devotion and that closeness with him. Now I think the Christian religion has that, but unfortunately what I found was that there were lots of words that were misused, there were certain things left out of the scriptures, possibly because they couldn't be written in those terms. Divine things that they couldn't write, people could not have comprehended them. I feel that needs to come back. And what I've found is that the East can help us bring that back.
Very nice.
Yeah, thank you. Certainly, within the Christian tradition, we have the idea that Christ becomes human, that humans might become divine. It's the idea that the goal of human life is to participate in God's own joy is that seems to me to be the best way I know of summarising what we think of as human purpose and human destiny, and we're all seeking to participate in divine life.
Frank.
Yes, just to finish again to thank everyone for coming on behalf of our joint venture. Next week, Father Michael Barnes from Heathrow College in London will be here, and he'll be talking about a series of moments in the history of the Christian encounter from the missionary period up to the present, possibly drawing on his work in Southall in London, how it forms will be speaking for us at 5 o'clock on what is Hinduism or defining Hinduism. And that will be what we're going to be able to listen to. And if you have extra time and would like to come for that, we'd definitely be happy to help you there too. But thank you to our speakers. Oh, yeah.
Related to the theme of today, tomorrow evening, 5 o'clock in Mansfield Council Room, Professor Rosalind Hackett from the University of Tennessee.